part one.
Now, without getting really, really heavy, really fast.
Okay.
What is the end time looking like according to what your scripture research has been like? Why don't you talk about your methodology a little bit and how you got to where you did really briefly, and then people, you know, how they can contact you to get more information, and then put us into where you think we're at.
Okay. Well, first I would start off with the verse that says, you know, Yeshua says, no one knows the day or the hour. And because that one's really the verse that causes everyone to think that you can't know when he's going to return. And in a sense, we can't. But in a sense, we can. It's not entirely correct when people say that you cannot know when he's going to return. Because it says right in Thessalonians that we are not ignorant of the times and the seasons, but that day should overtake us unawares. And so this phrase, day and the hour, if we take it back to the first century, when the apostles and emissaries, the disciples and all the followers of Yeshua in the first century, when they would have heard that term, they would have been reminded of a few things. Like, for example, the day and the hour, Yom Teruah, is what would have came to mind. This is a picture. It's called the last trump. When you read 1 Corinthians chapter 15, it talks about at the last trump that we shall be raised from the dead and we'll be made incorruptible. We receive our new immortal body. And so this last trump, well, the last trump is blown on the day of Yom Teruah. And there's actually three trumps that are preserved in the traditions of Judaism. And the first one is like Shavuot. The second one, or called the last trump, is Yom Teruah. And then you have what's called the Great Trump, and that's blown on Yom Kippur every 50th year to call in the Jubilee. And so we have these traditions here. And so at this last trump, this time of the resurrection, this time we'll be raised immortal. Well, this day of Yom Teruah is a day that falls on the timing of the new moon. And so you have to go out and you have to sight the new moon. And you don't know when it's going to show up. You don't know what day the seventh new moon is going to show up on the calendar. You don't know what hour is going to show up. And so this is where this phrase comes from. No one knows the day or the hour.
But in the Christian world, we've been taught that you can never know when the rapture is going to happen, right? And isn't that the way it's been interpreted?
Yes. And, of course, I don't believe in a rapture, a counterfeit one that
right.
will, you know, be to be presented as a counterfeit of the resurrection to duplicate Yeshua's return.
Right.
And what really would be something to set the stage to bring in the false Messiah. And, of course, that's always talked about separate from a resurrection. But when we read Thessalonians, it states clearly that the dead will be raised first, and then those of us who are alive and remain shall be caught up together in the air. And this also occurs after the Great Tribulation, because it says in Matthew chapter 24 that after the Great Tribulation, then shall the Son of Man be seen in the clouds of the sky, coming with great power and glory, and with all his holy angels. So
we're going to interrupt you as we go along
yeah.
and ask questions.
Sure, okay.
So I'll go for it.
Okay, go ahead. Well, I was just going to ask if you believe Yeshua is going to come between now and the end of tribulation. Or is that in your timeline?
Yes, it is in my timeline.
Okay. Well, I can wait.
I just wanted to clarify, just so people who don't know Yom Teruah, what it means, and don't know these things, we're talking about the Feast of Yahweh here. These are the holidays in the quote-unquote Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah, it's Leviticus chapter 23. Yahweh calls these his feasts, and what he's referring to is Pesach. Pesach is Passover. Then Shavuot is what the church would recognize as Pentecost, but that was actually something celebrated many, many millennium before the church started celebrating it. And then Yom Teruah is Day of Trumpets, and then that's followed by Yom Kippur, which is the Day of Atonement. And then after that, you have Sukkot, or the Feast of Tabernacles. And Yahweh says, these are my feast. And included among his feast is also the Sabbath, the seventh-day Sabbath. So when we're looking at these things, what we're looking at is prophetic pictures. And so you can begin with Passover. Well, what did that represent? I think even people in the church would recognize that Passover was symbolic of Yeshua and of his coming in some way. They might not understand all the details of that, but we know that he came as a Passover lamb, and it's through the blood of the lamb that we enter into the covenant. And then from there we enter into the Feast of Unleavened Bread and so on. And these were prophetic pictures of Yeshua's first coming. And then when you get to Shavuot, the day of Pentecost, that's when we see the people of the nations being called out and being grafted in to Israel at that point, becoming natural branches just like the natural branches were. And so that we can all be one. And the gospel could go forth from Israel into the world. And then the world in turn would have the opportunity to be grafted in and be saved as well, be redeemed as well, and be made one, echad, reunited with their maker as well. And that was all done through Yeshua at his first coming. But it's what we have here. If these prophetic pictures were embedded into the spring feast, then we can also look and see that there should be prophetic pictures embedded in the fall feast as well. And that's what we have. When we look at Yom Teruah, it says right there in chapter 15 of 1 Corinthians that it's at the sound of the last trump that we will be resurrected. And that last trump occurs on Yom Teruah, the feast. And that means that's the day when he's returned, because the resurrection occurs at his return. And so when he raises us from the grave, and then those of us who are alive and remain, then 10 days later on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, will be caught up in the air to meet them together. And then the wrath of the Father will be poured out on the remaining inhabitants of the earth who have not repented and have not come to salvation and who have rejected their opportunity to be reunited with their Maker. So these are the pictures that we have. And so once we understand that the day and the hour does not mean that we'll never know the seasons when he comes, because like I said earlier, Thessalonians says that we are not ignorant of the times of the seasons, that that day should overtake us like a thief in the night. So if that day won't overtake us as a thief in the night, and we're not ignorant of the times and seasons, then what do the times and seasons tell us? It gives us an idea of where we're at on the timeline. And so as what happened was about 1991, I started wondering, you know, I was looking through different Bibles, and in the backs of these scriptures, these various translations, we have different timelines. And I'd look at point A to point B on one timeline, and I saw a certain amount of time was calculated to have passed. Then I look in the back of another Bible, and between point A and point B, it would say a different amount of time passed for the same points of time. And so I'd scratch my head and wonder, okay, well, what's going on here? Why are these inconsistent? Is it that we don't know? Is that they have to guess, maybe use archaeological finds and historical material to try and just give an educated guess as to how much time passed? But I look at those genealogies and things in the scriptures, and they're very specific, you know, how much time passed from father to son, how much time passed from one king to another. And it just seemed to me odd that they couldn't come up with a conclusive timeline. So I started searching, but before I go into that, I'd like to mention also another guide that we have is some of the traditions, some of the things handed down to us actually through Judaism. Now I don't practice Judaism. I'm a Messianic believer, but I do believe in the Torah, and I believe in Yeshua, as it says in Revelations, that the remnant are those who are obedient to the commandments of Yahweh and who have the testimony of Yeshua. And so that's how I describe myself, is in that category. Even though I do have Jewish heritage, both on my mother's side, the tribe of Judah, and my father's side, the tribe of Levi. However, Judaism is a little bit different animal. However, there are things that were taught and preserved by the sages prior to Yeshua's coming that were very accurate in describing the first and second comings of Yeshua. Now, at that point in time, they thought it would be two different messiahs fulfilling two different roles. But it's what we actually have and we understand today, is this one messiah fulfilling two roles. And is what they understood at that time was that the first messiah would come on the fourth day from Adam. Now, to get this from Genesis chapter 1, it talks about on the first day, you know, there was light, and the light separated from the darkness, and even the morning were the first day. The sages taught that that was the light of Messiah. And then we go to the Gospel of John, the first chapter. This is confirmed that indeed that light of the first day was Yeshua. But, however, then 4 days later, you have the sun and the moon and the stars created. And so they teach that because that's when you could start counting the days to determine the Modim, that is, the Modim are the appointed times, because you couldn't do that apart from the sun and the moon. They have to be there before you can calculate when the Modim, the appointed times, will be. So since that ability to calculate the appointed times began on the fourth day, then they calculated that the Messiah, the first one, would come on the fourth day from Adam. That is the year 4000. So they're picture of who this first Messiah would be was of a suffering servant. They called him Ben Yosef. And the suffering servant, they believed, would come riding on a donkey, that he would die for the sins of the people, the typical, you know, Isaiah 53 picture, that he would, that sin would continue in the world after he died, and that the temple would be destroyed after he died. And then they had a picture of a second Messiah, which they called Ben David, the son of David, who would come in as a conquering king. And the conquering king Messiah would be the one, he would come on the sixth day from Adam, or the year 6000, and he would reign in the millennial kingdom and establish Yahweh's government on earth for all eternity from that point forward. And so with these pictures, we get an idea and the key ones that fit in with this timeline is the 4th day and the 6th day. That is the year 4000 and the year 6000, because these mark Jubilee dates. And specifically, the year 4000 marks the Jubilee date of 80, the 80th Jubilee, and the year 6000 marks the 120th Jubilee. And these numbers, 80 and 120, are very significant, and that's what I'll cover after our commercial break, what these patterns mean and how they fit into the timeline.
And just before we go into that, I was wondering if you could quickly explain what a Jubilee is for those who don't know.
Yes, a Jubilee is a 50-year cycle. You can read about those in Leviticus chapter 25, and it describes the sabbatical cycles of years for rest of the land, which is every seventh year. And then after the seven cycles of 7 years for rest of the land, then the 50th year is a Jubilee year. And it's a picture of the return of our inheritance. It's when we receive our eternal inheritance. But prior to receiving that eternal inheritance, is what it is a restoration of our original inheritance that had given to us at the time that we left Egypt and came into the promised land. And so what you have there is a return of the inheritance to the original owners. And so, for example, let's say, you know, I just inherited my land, and so now I have 50 years, and I can do whatever I want with it. And I decide, though, that farming is really not my thing. And so I go ahead and I lease out my land to somebody or rent it. You know, really, in a Jubilee, there's really not much distinction between the two. And so I rent it out. And let's say at the time I rent it out, there's 23 agricultural cycles left before the next Jubilee. Okay, so what I'm doing is I'm selling or renting out those 23 remaining agricultural cycles. And then at the end of those 23 agricultural cycles, I get my land back.
Mm-hmm. So this is a genius economic system.
Yeah, absolutely. Really, yeah, because you never lose your inheritance.
You're listening to the Hebrew Nation Morning Show with Hezekiah Haas talking about the timeline that he has developed. It's a great one. Hope you stay tuned.
זמן מסמן לי זה הכל שריות של החיים.
Yeah, so we finished up that part, and we got to these patterns of 80 and 120. And this is significant, because we have these pictures here. Remember when it said about Moses, it said, Yahweh said that I will raise up a prophet unlike unto Moshe, and that the people, you know, they'll need to listen to him. Whoever doesn't listen to him, they'll be held accountable. And so if there's a prophet like unto Moshe, who could that possibly be? Well, we have a few patterns here. And, of course, we know that this pattern leads to someone who is much more than a prophet. A prophet, yay, even the son of Yahweh himself, who came to redeem us from our sins. And so what are some of those patterns that establish this link? Well, remember, Moshe was 80 years old when he brought the children of Israel out of the bondage of Egypt. And so when we come to an 80th Jubilee, that is 80 times 50-year cycles. So you take 80 times 50, then you end up with 4,000. So what do we have? We have Yeshua coming to deliver us from the bondage of sin. And then you have another picture. And remember, we had the two pictures of two messiahs, one a suffering servant, one a conquering king. Mm-hmm. Well, what happened at the 120th year of Moses? Well, he died. Yeshua, the son of Nun, rose up in his place, and then he took Israel into the promised land as a conquering king. Mm-hmm. And so the year 6,000, the 120th Jubilee, that will mark what? Will mark when Yeshua comes as a conquering king to take us into the promised land. And then, like Moses, he went on a mountain, he received instruction for the children of Israel. And what did Yeshua do? He also, when he went on top of the mountain, remember the Sermon on the Mount? He went up there, he received instruction, and gave it to his disciples and to the children of Israel. Moshe went down to Egypt. Yeshua went down to Egypt. Moshe had 12 elders, and under that he had 70 elders, and Yeshua had 12 disciples, and then later he sent out 70 disciples in twos to go and minister to the people. And so you have all these parallels between the two, and it's very interesting. And so if we have these patterns, then that seems significant. And here's another curiosity, because when you get back to this pattern of 120, well, Noah, in Noah's day, in chapter 6, it says that my spirit shall not strive with man forever, but his years shall be 120. Well, Noah was 500 years old when he was given that message by Yahweh. But there's a problem with that, because the flood came when Noah was 600 years old. Well, that's only 100 years. But Yahweh said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, but his years shall be 120. Well, this word years, it can be, doesn't just mean years. It means literally revolutions of time. So was he saying really a revolution, a Jubilee revolution of time? perhaps? Because if you do that, well, 120 times 50 is 6,000. Well, if the earth was destroyed the first time by water, and the prophecies of the future make it clear that, that the earth is going to be destroyed by fire the next time, well, the year 6,000, 120 Jubilee, sounds like we have another picture that fits right in place there. So maybe that's what that's talking about in Genesis chapter 6 concerning Noah.
Wow.
And so what is it that makes my timeline different than others, you might ask? Well, a couple of things. One, I use 50-year cycles instead of 49. I think all of the other calendars that I've come across out there go by 49 Jubilee year cycles, and this doesn't work for one big reason, and that's because it says in chapter 25 of Leviticus, it states that you shall plant and harvest your fields for 6 years, and in the seventh year, the land shall rest. But also in the Jubilee year, it says you shall not plant or harvest in a Jubilee year. So if that's the case, then the Jubilee year cannot be the first year of the next six-year cycle, because the six-year cycle is a planting cycle, but the Jubilee year is a non-planting year. And this is confirmed with Hezekiah in 2 Kings, where it says the same thing. After Yahweh spoke to King Hezekiah, and he told him that the siege that was had come against Jerusalem by the king of Assyria, and he said, don't worry about it. The king of Assyria, he's going to go away, and he's not going to bother you anymore, and this is going to be assigned to you. And you shall eat this year such as grows of itself. Okay, so that implies the seventh year rest of the land. And in the second year, what springs from the same. Okay, so there is a Jubilee year. And then in the third year, you shall plant and reap. And so that's the first year of the next six-year cycle. So this is why I use the 50-year cycles. Now, when we do this, we come up with some interesting things. We come up with three different Jubilees that can be identified in this timeline. And apart from this cycle, you can't see that. You may see the one that Yeshua announced, because in Luke chapter 4, Yeshua proclaimed the acceptable year of Yahweh. Well, that's a Hebrew idiom referring to the year of Jubilee. And so you can count to and from that. And there's a third one that none of the other ones have come up with because of the 49-year cycle. You can't find it. But it turns out that Jericho was also a Jubilee year. And it was the 51st Jubilee, in fact. King Hezekiah's was the 66th Jubilee from Adam. And then when Yeshua came, that was the 80th Jubilee from Adam. And all the counting on this calendar begins with Adam. Another thing distinguishes my calendar from other calendars, and that's that the other calendars will have gaps in them. In other words, if you read the calendar, you'll see some basic things used like Jubilee cycles, and they'll say, okay, based on Jubilee patterns, this date appears to fall here, and this date appears to fall here. And then the other places in between or outside of that, they'll guess at how much time passed. But in my calendar, which I put together, every single point of the calendar is supported by Scripture. And you can go to the Scripture, and the Scripture itself will tell you exactly how much time passed. So we have these patterns, once again, of Jubilees, but you can't base a timeline just on that pattern alone. You have to see what did the Scripture say passed. And so there's no guesswork in my timeline. And so what I discovered the first time when I tried to put this together, like I mentioned earlier in the show, is that, you know, why is it that these timelines in the back of these Bibles don't agree with each other? You know, they're both describing point A to point B, but they're having a different conclusion. And so, well, it's what I found out when I just put the first rough draft together. And this is kind of what got me thinking about the Jubilees, is because when I put my first draft together, it was 3,999 years is what it landed on. And going, wow, you know, that's just amazing. I put a rough draft together, not even really trying, and I'm within 1 year of a Jubilee year. And I'm like, well, that's fascinating. That seems kind of unusual. It seems like that's significant. It seems like there must be something to that. And so then I started, you know, going into Genesis and the 120-year thing and some of the other things I started thinking about, and it occurred to me, hey, you know, that's the 80th Jubilee. Then I saw all these other patterns that I described earlier about the 80 and 120 and so on. And so I wanted to go back, and I want to see if I could find some loose ends, if there's any scriptures I missed, or if there's any fractions of years I could find. And I actually did. I went in there and I found several fractions of years. There's a couple kings that they reigned for just 3 moons each. One reigned for 3 moons, the other one reigned for 3 moons and 10 days. Then a King Zedekiah, when Ezra was, or Judah more specifically, was taken off into the Babylonian captivity, it was the 10th year of King Zedekiah's reign, in the fourth moon, the 17th day. So I said, oh, I got 4 moons and 17 days here. And there's a few other ones, Noah's flood, they got a little fraction from there, and I think one or two other places. And well, by the time I added all the fractions up, I had a total of 1 year and 14 days. I go, well, that's fascinating too. Because now I have exactly 4,000 years and 14 days. And so you might ask why that's fascinating, because after all, it would seem more fascinating maybe if it was exactly 4,000 years. But no, actually, it's more fascinating that's 4,000 years and 14 days. And that's because, remember, I'm counting Jubilee to Jubilee. You have three different calendars, and one of them is the redemptive calendar. That's the one that all the Modim, the appointed times, fall within. They're called the summer feast, biblically, even though we call them spring feast and fall feast. But that's the redemptive calendar, and it begins with the first moon, and the first appointed time, of course, is Passover. And then the last appointed time of that cycle is Shemini Atzeret, which is tagged on the end of Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles. Okay, but then you have the regnal calendar, which marks the coronation of the kings, which goes from Yom Teruah to Yom Teruah. And that's an age-old debate, actually. Some scholars actually debate whether it was possibly Passover to Passover. But I've chosen the coronation day to be on Yom Teruah to Yom Teruah myself, because it slightly has a little bit more weight of evidence to it, even though the other one has some merit to it as well. But there's a lot of patterns that disappear if you use a Passover to Passover one. So because so many patterns fit in with this one, it causes me to be more confident that this is the correct way to measure it, because there's just amazing things that come to the surface, the Yom Teruah to Yom Teruah pattern. And then you have the third calendar, and that's the Jubilee cycle calendar. And that's the one that marks the year of release. You know, it's the acceptable year of Yahweh. It's the year when everything is restored. And the reason why that is because if you own a farm, and it's time for you to get your agricultural inheritance back, well, you don't want to do that in the springtime, in the first moon, because you're not going to have time to plant your crops. So you get it back at the end of the previous year's harvest. So that concludes with Sukkot, and so when that's over, now immediately the Jubilee is proclaimed, and now you get your property back, and now you have time to move back onto your property. The other people have time to move off of it. You have time to prepare your soil and, you know, to plow and do whatever you need and get the seed ready. And so by the time spring comes, you have a crop. Yeah. And so that's why it starts in the fall.
You know, if you're actually walking in the feasts and doing them, a lot of this becomes a lot less confusing too, because you understand, you know, you don't want to plant a crop right after Passover. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah,
it's going to be rainy and
and you need time to make the transition back to your property.
Right.
So, you know, so for the purpose of this timetable, though, I use the regnal calendar, going from Yom Teruah to Yom Teruah, and the Jubilee cycles, which of course are Yom Kippur, and then every 50th Yom Kippur after that. So. And starting from Adam. So when we do this, why is this pattern interesting? Well, this is one of the patterns that come to the surface when you use the regnal calendar from Yom Teruah. And that's because this 14th day, if you go to the 14th day, where does that land you? That will land you on the 14th day of the 7th moon. So the 7th moon, 14 days, what's on the 15th of the 7th moon? Sukkot. So this would place Yeshua's birth on the first day of Sukkot.
Nice.
Yeah, interesting.
And then also, 8 days later, he'd be circumcised.
That's right, exactly. On Shemini Atzeret, new beginnings.
Yep.
And that's what he was. He was a new beginning for us. Mm-hmm. And so, and also in reinforcement of this, this is also the same time, if you plug this calendar and you find an anchor point, and I'll go a little bit more into anchor points a little bit later, but you go in and find an anchor point, let's say it's 3 BCE. Well, if you do that, what you'll find is what they believe to be the Star of Bethlehem, which appeared in the fall of 3 BCE in the 7th moon, just prior to Yeshua's birth. And the Star of Bethlehem is really amazing. It's not just a star that just showed up one time and then it was gone. It actually showed up five times, and it was the result of a conjunction between multiple planets. And it showed up first in AG month in a minor kind of way, and then right around Yom Teruah, just within a few days of that, it showed up again in the 7th moon. Then it showed up in FEB month. When I say FEB, I mean pagan February, and so on and so forth. And then two more times until finally, the last time, it showed up for like 3 days. And it like hovered because the conjunction, it was a really big one. And so it took 3 days before the brightness of it disappeared. And so the wise men were able to follow this. It was like a beacon in the sky that flashed, you know, five different times, and then the final time it rested there over Bethlehem for 3 days, so making it easy for them to identify where to find the child who had been born. And so it's pretty neat. Another interesting thing that comes from this, though, is that if you count backwards, nine moons, which is, you know, the time that it takes a child to be conceived and then brought to birth, well, if you go back nine moon cycles from Sukkot, in that particular year. This doesn't work every year, but it works this year. You go back 9 moon cycles, you land on Hanukkah.
Hanukkah,
yep.
Nice.
Yep, sometimes it's a month off, so it doesn't work, because then you'd be in the womb for 10 months. But this year, 9 months backwards is Hanukkah.
And that is the Festival of Lights.
Yes.
Which is interesting, because he's the light of the world, isn't he?
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Conceived in the womb during the time of the Feast of Lights, dedication. And, just fascinating stuff that ties into here. Let's see here. What else can we go into? We have, some more things. Okay, anchor points. We can go into that. Okay, we had this one anchor point where if we take 3 BC as the time of his birth, well, are there some other things that we can plug into here to see if it matches up? Well, yes, there are. Remember at the time that Yochanan the Immerser, John the Baptizer, when he began his ministry, he was born about 6 months before Yeshua, and it says that he began his ministry in the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar. So the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar just happened to fall in 26 CE. I say CD instead of AD. So if you're wondering what I'm saying, when I say CE, I'm referring to the Catholic AD. But CE refers to common era, and I prefer to use that as opposed to the Catholic term. So I'll use BCE instead of BC, and I'll use CE instead of AD. And so 26 CE would be the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar's reign, which is the first year of Yochanan the Immerser's ministry. And that would begin in the fall, because it also goes from fall to fall for the reign of the Caesars. And so Yochanan's ministry had to begin after the completion of that 15th year. So that's the year 26 in the fall when Yochanan began his ministry. There's a 6-month difference between his birth and Yeshua's birth. So then you go forward 6 months. And so that marks the potential beginning of Yeshua's ministry. Well, that will place Yeshua's ministry in the spring of 27 CE. So with that in hand, is there another anchor we can plug in there that would give us a year date for Yeshua's ministry and confirm the year 3 BCE for Yeshua's birth? Well, yes, there is. It says in the scriptures also, in Luke, it says that when Yeshua began to be 30 years old, he began his ministry. Okay, that word began in the Greek is the word hosi, which is means approaching a number without going over it. So that means that he was approaching his 30th year, but he is not past his 30th year yet. That meant that he was probably 29 and just starting his 30th year. So if you take 3 BCE and you add 29 years to it, then you land in 27 CE. Okay, so there's another confirmation, 27 CE. So that's 2 anchors there that land at that point. But there's a third one. That's not the end of it. So our third anchor is when he was in the temple and tearing things apart, rebuking them and cleansing the temple. Then they questioned him, they challenged him and said, well, by what authority do you do this? And then Yeshua says, I will take this temple and I will destroy it and raise it up in 3 days. And then they said, this temple has been 46 years in the building, and will you raise it up in 3 days? And, you know, saying that, mocking him. So now we have a 46-year timeline here. Well, the building of the temple began in the year 2019 BCE. So if you count 46 years forward from that point, then you end up in, again, 27 CE as being the latest possible time for the beginning of his ministry. So all these things work together and provide a real clear anchor of how to overlap this timetable with the Gregorian calendar. The Gregorian calendar is the one that we use today in our modern society. And so now that we have these anchor points of 3 BCE and 27 CE confirmed with, you know, 4 more anchor points, we have a pretty good idea now when the 80th Jubilee occurred. So when Yeshua went in the synagogue and read out of Isaiah, and he proclaimed the acceptable year of Yahweh, the Jubilee year, then we can pin that down to 27 CE. So if that was the 80th Jubilee, and then we fast forward to the 120th Jubilee from there, that lands us in 2027 on the Gregorian calendar for the 120th Jubilee.